We're live.
All right, there we go.
Welcome everybody to another wonderful episode of the Market Made Easy here with the Maxwell Group, and we've got a very special guest today.
Well, thank you,
Jason. How are you today? This is
doing
Jason
good,
Hostler with Hostler Wealth Management.
Hostler Wealth Management. That's right.
Nailed it again.
You got it.
You're doing great.
I'm killing it.
Yes.
So thank you so much for joining us today. We have some interesting stuff to talk about, I think.
And, I think so. Chris and I were having kind of like a pre-podcast powwow out in the truck in the snow and rain.
Little pregame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. Just, you know, asking a lot of stuff about trusts and, oh goodness, we're going to get into it because, I mean, he started going off and I'm like, you need to save that stuff.
Yeah. We decided to save it until we were in here in front of the microphones.
Put a pin in it so we can we can really dive.
We'll
right
see if I can
in.
Actually remember it all again.
Okay. Yeah. We'll get there.
So, I know that we try and tie in all of our guests into real estate somehow.
Yeah.
And I know that we kind of talked beforehand about there's going to be some real estate and some just general information as well, which I think is really cool. But let's jump in, shall we? Let's talk. First of all, what do you do?
Okay, so I'm a wealth advisor. So what I do is I help specifically retirees and widows here in town make smart financial and tax decisions.
And you also, but not just them. I mean, there's other people too. Like
there are other people, but you know, retirees and widows have specific needs that we've kind of created a niche for ourselves and specializing to help them with their special cases. So, you know, when somebody dies, there's a lot of work that has to happen. And, you know, a lot of times you're in an emotionally fragile state. And so, you know, having somebody who you trust there to walk you through all the steps and to take care of everything, you know, that's one of the most rewarding, actually, things that I get to do is to help people in their one of their biggest times of needs in their life. Losing your loved one, that's the hardest thing.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, not fun for anybody.
No. But, you know, we're all going to die. So it's good to be prepared and have someone you trust to be there to help you.
And taxes, the only two guarantees in life, and
you
help with both.
That's right.
All right.
So not a bad way to plan business around the only two guarantees in life, right?
Absolutely.
So I've been doing this for 7 years this last month. My dad started the business 22 years ago, and I wanted to have nothing to do with him at first, you know, like most young men.
Yeah.
I wanted to go off and do my own thing, and I dropped out of college. I got into working for a software company, and turns out it was, of course, a financial software company. And as I was starting my career with them and going down that path, I kind of took a step back, and I wanted to, you know, figure out what kind of life I wanted to have, what kind of career I wanted to have, where I wanted to live, and raise a family possibly. And I decided to talk to my dad if there would ever be an opportunity to perhaps work with him and maybe go down a different path. And a month later, I was back up here in Prescott and studying for my Series 7 test to become a stockbroker. And things have been flying ever since then.
Wow. That's all.
I remember, actually, when I met you, you were my brother's roommate.
Yes.
In a little apartment
down in Mesa. Yeah.
And, definitely... Not on the path to being a financial advisor.
No. Me and Jeff and Drew were mostly playing.
Long time ago.
Mostly playing Halo those days.
Yes.
Yeah.
Playing a lot of video games.
Like that.
But times have changed. I kind of had a similar life path.
You know,
real estate's been my unofficial family business since the early 1900s. And I just didn't think I wanted to get into it.
Right.
You're actually really good at it.
Really? And then I was like, maybe I should give it a shot.
Yeah.
I got tired of working in,
aren't you glad that
in the corporate America situation?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's good to be in the family business sometimes.
It is. And, you know, it gives me an opportunity that I don't think a lot of people do is when you get into a business and you're young, you're having to hustle and you're having to try and make ends meet and you're having to worry about the future. And in the financial business, there's so many people out there that I feel don't do right by their clients that are either looking out for themselves or they just don't have enough knowledge or, you know, it's too hard to actually do all the work that I think people are looking for. And when you have all those pressures, plus you don't know if you're going to be able to, you know, have food next week, you know, because you haven't sold enough commission product or whatever it happens to be, you know, if you're always having to hunt for your next kill, I think that that causes people to maybe not give the best advice to clients. And so luckily, you know, my dad has an established business already. He had to go through all those hard times and figure out how to do it all right. So where I've come in and I've learned how to do it right from the very beginning for clients without having to worry of where my next paycheck's coming from. Mm-hmm. And Certainly so helpful. Getting the opportunity to learn it that way, I think has been a big help for me because now I have that knowledge. And even if I had to go build it all from the ground again, mm-hmm. I would know how to do it right.
Okay.
That's really cool. So one of the things that I have a question for you about, because it interests me and I think it'll interest our viewers and listeners as well. You know, and in your realm of working with the stock market and things like that is this thing called a REIT.
Yeah. A real estate investment trust.
Yeah. Explain to us how, you know, high level, of course, how that works and how people can use that to their advantage.
Okay. So REITs are a really cool way to participate in real estate without having to be a landlord yourself. Basically, you're delegating to somebody else the responsibilities of what a landlord would generally do. Collect the rent, do the upkeep, maintenance, you know, manage all the tax reporting, everything like that, administration that goes along with, you know, being a landlord or having a real estate empire. And a lot of times you'll find that commercial property, if you go into a big city, if you go into Phoenix, San Francisco, LA, New York, a lot of these big buildings are owned by real estate investment trusts. They're professional companies that are created to manage, you know, large tranches of real estate. And so, you know, you get the effects of specialization. They're really good at doing it well. And then, you know, their investors invest and they get a return. Now, of course, you can make more if you're a hands-on real estate person. You almost always can do that. You're going to get better yields than you're going to get in a REIT. But the whole idea of a REIT is that you're giving up a little bit of that to, you know, have somebody else do that for you and still get real estate returns and exposure in your portfolio to real estate.
Somebody explained it to me once as it's kind of like a mutual fund, but instead of companies, it's properties.
It is. It's very, very similar to a mutual fund in that you're getting exposure to a lot of different properties in most REITs, like you would in a mutual fund, get exposure to a lot of different company stocks. It is very much that kind of concept. Now, it's not always that way. You can have a real estate investment trust that has just one property, but most of your, for example, publicly traded real estate investment trusts are going to have a lot of different properties.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so say somebody wanted to get in on one of those type of situations, you know, they're maybe not quite in a position yet to start purchasing whole properties to hold on their own, but they would like to get involved in one of these REITs. What's the best way to kind of get your feet wet in that?
So the easiest way to do that would probably be participating in the publicly traded REITs that are out there, trade on the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay.
You know, you can get go to any of the brokerages out there, the Vanguards, the TD Ameritrades, all those places that, you know, offer that. Talk to your current financial advisor, you know, if you're looking for a new one, you know, I'm around. And, you know, the publicly traded REIT would be the easiest way to get into that sort of situation. Now, like for almost all investments, you have the easy publicly available all the way up to the highly specialized and very exclusive where you have to be an accredited investor. There's a whole range of things that people can do in that area that you can get some real estate exposure in your portfolio.
Cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me, you know, that.
And you can do it for a lot less money, you know, like you can buy REITs as shares.
Yeah,
you can buy a share, you know, as opposed to. You see them trading for, you know, a lot less than just a single family home that you could rent out would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of a way to break into the market a little bit sooner than you might be able to.
Right.
Otherwise, yeah.
So kind of keeping on that, you manage portfolios, you know, like you mentioned, for, you know, a lot of retirees and things of that nature. What should the average investor look at when they're putting real estate into their portfolio?
You know what? That's a good question. There's a lot of things that'll actually enter into that, you know. For real estate professionals that we work with for managing, you know, portfolios, they're going to have a much higher overall exposure to real estate because they're doing that professionally. Mm-hmm. If you have a typical retiree, it's going to be a lot less than that. And then you have to think about things like a person's risk tolerance. You know, are they going to be able to sleep at night with how much volatility in their, you know, in their portfolio? If they see the news and they see that the market's, you know, pulling back, you know, is that something that's appropriate for that person to have in there? And so you're actually going to find us making those recommendations on an individual basis for different people after we've really gotten to know them. We have an entire process that we go through for new clients where we spend actually hours asking them questions about themselves and their lives, their values, their goals, interests, hobbies, really getting to know them on a deep level before we even get to the point where we're looking at making recommendations. And then you have to take into account, you know, what the overall market's doing. You know, for a publicly traded REIT, for example, if you have exposure to that, that's going to be trading on the open market, and it's going to suffer correlation from other asset classes based on what's going on in the market. Whereas if you own an actual piece of real estate, you know, the value might be, you might look at that from a cash flow standpoint rather than what you could actually buy or sell that for on the marketplace.
So it kind of isolates you.
Right. And so there's a lot of different, you know, there's different ways that people value investments, you know, and so you got to take all of these different factors into account when you're looking at a real estate exposure. For a lot of people, I would say, even if they're real estate heavy in overall portfolios, we don't tend to see more than about 10% for your average investor, but it can definitely go up and down from there. There's no hard and fast rule.
Cool.
So I have a question, because I think when we were talking before, I think that people don't realize all of the ins and outs that they're going to have to deal with when there is a life change, when somebody, like somebody dies in the family,
right,
and they're basically in charge of handling all of that. And I think there's a huge value from your perspective in helping them walk through each step, because like you were saying, I mean, can you explain a little bit about that process and what that looks like for somebody who is dealing with a life change like that?
Yeah, that is, that can be one of the hardest things to definitely go through, that process when somebody dies and you're having to deal with what's left here in our world. So the first thing is to just breathe. Nothing has to be done right away. You know, the grieving process is a time-consuming thing, and it's different for everybody. But there's no need to rush and try and, you know, get things all taken care of that week. You know, you got to work on making sure you and your family are taken care of first of all. After that, you know, there's some administrative steps that generally have to happen. You have to get death certificates for that you're going to need for various things like claiming life insurance, for proving to various accounts that the person's dead. You know, if the person has a trust, you're going to have to, you know, be working with the trustee and the beneficiaries to start fulfilling their wishes that are listed in the trust for how assets are supposed to be distributed, or perhaps even held in the trust and providing income to beneficiaries. So when people decide how they want, you know, their estates to be handled, they have a lot of decisions to make. And so you can be dealing with a very simple case where they're just, well, I left everything to my wife, to where, you know, I'm doing this for this charity, I'm doing this for the grandkids, I'm doing this for, you know, Bob down the street. And I've seen cases with all of those. And sometimes it can be a complex administrative hurdle. Sometimes it's not. And it all depends on what the person wants to do. So I think it's always good to make sure you retain somebody to help you in those situations and not always try and do it alone. Even as a professional, you know, I work very closely with my staff and with my dad in those cases to make sure we're crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's and making sure everything's followed up on. It's a very complex process that, you know, after, you know, seeing several times over the last several years or 7 years, you know, that I've been doing this, I still think I can learn more about and improve my skill set on.
Okay. So, so you're kind of the gateway to bringing in the people that they know are going to be the right people. So they say, this is what I want to do. Then you say, okay, great. I'm going to bring in this guy. I'm going to do this. I'm going to get this going.
And not just in the case of a life change like that. We try to be that for our clients overall. We try to be the financial quarterback for our clients' lives. So, you know, if we're, you know, working on risk management for clients, you know, we're considering how their not just their portfolio investment, but, you know, do you have insurance in case, you know, you're incapacitated and you're no longer able to carry on your business? Do you have insurance in case you die and you're taking care of your family? Mm-hmm. Then we're looking at estate planning. You know, if mm-hmm. someone dies, you know, what do you want to have happen? What needs to be taken care of in that case? How do we fulfill your wishes? You know, retirement planning, you know, the whole thing that we're participating in here, capitalism. Retirement is just, you know, capitalism's endgame. You finally made enough that you can live off of your earnings. Mm-hmm. And so that takes planning. You know, have we saved enough? What is our withdrawal strategies? Are we, you know, using a buckets of money approach? Are we using all the different theoretical aspects that go into planning something like that? So all these different places, you know, pulling in the bookkeeper, the accountant, the estate planning right. attorney, creating pulling in trust, all yeah. these people and having the right people to do the job. We want to be the quarterback to put those people together for mm-hmm. our clients and, you know, make sure that everything's going right.
Mm-hmm. It just, yeah, it's way more complex than it seems, you know, and it really is. And it blows my mind because there's, you know, my wife and I were doing some of our estate planning right
okay.
now. One of my first thoughts was, I can probably do this. I can go on that.
Right, pull up a will.
And then she's like, no, I know this person. She does this for a living. Let's talk to her about it. And she starts asking questions and questions. And I'm like, super glad I didn't just throw this together on the internet.
Right. Well, I'm sure in your guys' profession, don't you get that too? Why do I need a realtor? You know, why do I need a real estate agent? You know, I can sell this place or I can buy a place, right? Yeah. They don't realize all the nuances they can enter in.
I don't know what I'm doing.
Exactly. And that's definitely one of the things that, you know, having a profession has made me realize that getting experts to help you in any area of life is a very valuable thing to do. And, you know, like, you know, I don't do all my own things myself, you know, like I have an insurance guy for my health insurance that, you know, is looking at that in detail. You know, I don't try to work on my own teeth. You know, if I wanted to spend the time to go to school and, you know, get an expensive mirror set up, I could probably get in there and do it. But, you know, that's not the best use of my time. And I think for most people, hiring a professional to take care of the aspects of your life where mm-hmm. it's required almost, or where you're going to get the most bang for your buck, it's probably a good thing.
Right. And also just bringing in people that you trust, because I think there are so many people that make really bad mistakes by picking the wrong people. Like you said, the people that are just telling you what you want to hear and not thinking about all of the bird's eye view things, like you are looking at the whole picture. Like you were saying something about how, like, if you just take this one document to the lawyer to write up and they go, okay, here you go. And you're like, okay, now what do I do with it?
Right. If you got a trust. Yeah. Have you funded the trust? Have you retitled the assets? Have you looked at your beneficiary structure of, you know, your IRAs and making sure that that's congruent with the rest of your estate plan overall? Are you looking at your life insurance beneficiary? There's a whole lot of steps beyond just preparing a trust and signing it that you have to do for estate planning.
Absolutely. And you know, it's a whole lot of $20 words for most people who have a $10 vocabulary.
Exactly. And
myself included in a lot of those situations. It's, you know, it's not putting anybody down whatsoever, but it's a lot of big words and complex practices for people who just, they're not prepared to do it.
I mean, all these people, you know, they're getting all this schooling, you know, and certifications and going through all of this. It's for a reason, because they're learning how all these things work together. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
oversight in your industry is, especially now,
it's pretty crazy.
It's pretty intense.
Yeah, you guys were talking about the Dodd-Frank Act little bit in your episode last week. And, you know, looking with the new makeup of Congress and looking forward towards 2020, I'm thinking that most likely my industry is going to have even more regulation in the future.
Oh, my gosh. I know. It seems simple until you get into it. And then you're like, I know, but this has to go with this. And then we have to make sure that that's, you know, good. And meetings and who do I choose? Right. And
well, one thing that enters into that, I want to get back to what you said about trust, you know.
Yeah.
My profession is all about trust and making sure that we're doing what's right for the clients. And so the thing you want to look out for financial advisors is whether or not they're a fiduciary, if they have to put the client's interest ahead of theirs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, whoever you're working with, ask them if they are held to a fiduciary standard to put your interest above their own. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not every person who holds themselves out as a financial advisor or wealth advisor is required to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go take a life insurance test and a Series 66 test, and you can sell an annuity and call yourself an advisor, and you don't actually have any legal fiduciary standard that you're held to.
Okay.
You have a best interest standard that's there, and a suitability standard, and those are much more lax than a fiduciary standard. And so, you know, those back end regulation legal things, people don't know about that.
Right. So we need to ask them if they're a fiduciary.
Right. And so, you know, I would like to see, you know, and it looks like the SEC and FINRA is working towards a uniform fiduciary standard for the industry. And, you know, there was the Department of Labor was working on a rule that was going to apply to retirement accounts that the Trump administration kept from going through. And that could have made some things better, could have made some things confusing, but I'm hoping that our industry eventually moves towards a uniform standard where anybody given financial advice has to put their clients' interests first.
Yeah, absolutely.
That just makes sense.
Seems to make a whole lot more sense than apparently what's there now.
Yeah. And but at the same time, I think that they don't want to make everybody have to just do the same thing. They want to, you know, give people freedom to invest how they want. You know, you've got people who call up wanting to invest in the strangest things.
Really? That's,
yes.
Okay, all right. Tell us more about that.
Spill it.
Oh, I mean, so, you know, how can I invest in people who make bolts for submarines? That's a call I've gotten. I'm sure right now that, you know, people are so all confused. Obviously all interested in the semi-legality of cannabis.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, so you hear that on the news all the time. And, you know, I think by the time you hear it on the news, maybe it's a
too
little
late.
Too... Yeah, I've heard that before.
It's too late.
Too late.
Yeah. You know, I'd have liked to own, you know, Google...
Yeah,
15 years ago, that'd have been great.
Well, I was one of those guys who somebody approached me to buy a thing called Bitcoin.
Bitcoin, yes,
and
cryptocurrency,
and it was like $2 a coin.
Yeah,
and I was like, that sounds stupid. That's never gonna take off.
Yeah, I have a similar experience. We almost put $5,000.
Well, had I done it, I know exactly when I would have pulled my money out.
Right.
When you go through a career change, it's a good time to liquidate not exactly stable investments, and it would have been an amazing time to liquidate that Bitcoin that I would have bought at $2 a coin when it was, you know, 10,000 a coin.
Well, you know, and that's why hindsight's 20/20, and my crystal ball works just as well as everybody else's. You know, and so when you're actually looking at this with somebody, with you guys as younger professionals, you know, getting your careers really to the money earning stages, what you need is more liquid emergency funds rather than something that could, you know, have extreme volatility and value like Bitcoin.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so those considerations, of course, always have to be made on a person by person basis, because your entire personal situation, your income, your budget, your family life, all these things enter into, you know, how much liquid emergency reserves do I need?
Mm-hmm.
And how much should I be putting into my 401k? How much should I be doing to all that? All that stuff is always going to come down to individual considerations. And that's why I think people need to be doing financial planning and looking
absolutely.
At, you know, an overall financial plan for their lives.
Okay.
So speaking of younger people, what's a good financial strategy to get started in some minor investing? I think I wish someone had kicked me in the head a lot earlier in life and said, you know, you should really start investing some money in
definitely
in some things. You know, so what's a good strategy in your opinion? For younger people to get started.
So a strategy I've always been fond of is the old adage from The Richest Man in Babylon, which is an old book from the 30s, which is pay yourself first. So you have all these other people that you pay, all these bills in life, but, you know, why don't you ever pay yourself? So you pay yourself first.
Okay.
So you pay yourself, and in the book they like to say 10%, and so that creates a savings. Now you're saving. Well, Luckily, here in the United States, we've got some really cool laws that give us ways to save tax advantageously. So does your workplace have any kind of retirement plan? A lot of times, you know, you'll get a match. That's money that you'd otherwise been leaving on the table. So you got to look at what's available for you from work and then look at, you know, IRAs and Roth IRAs as other tax advantage ways, you know, to save.
What's the fundamental difference between an IRA and a Roth IRA?
So an IRA, you get a tax deduction now, but you pay taxes on in retirement. A Roth IRA, it's not giving you a deduction now, but it's tax-free when you take it out in retirement.
Yeah, okay.
I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of tax-free personally. Yeah. And, you know, what we see, you know, happening in the world, we think that there's a good chance we see much higher taxes in all of our futures and that the current tax rates, you know, they might be the lowest that we ever see. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I agree with you on that one. What do you know? Do you know anything about self-directed IRAs?
I do. I do.
Unfortunately, you know?
It's unfortunate that I do know about them because I see them go wrong more often than not.
Gosh, yeah.
And that's the problem. And so, you know, you'll see a lot of this probably in the real estate business. People want to do real estate through a self-directed IRA. They're like, okay, cool. You know, I'm not allowed to, you know, buy a house with my IRA, but if I do a self-directed IRA, then I can. So why not? Well, the issue is that they have a lot of compliance requirements. Mm-hmm. And if you make a mistake, like for example, let's say that you got the rent check and you accidentally deposited it in a personal account rather than an IRA account. Well, there's possibilities out there by making a mistake like that you can make the entire amount of your IRA, self-directed IRA, taxable in 1 year.
Oh, yeah.
And so we've seen that happen where people co-mingle funds. And when that happens in a self-directed IRA, it can cause taxability of non-liquid assets. Which is just a bad situation to be in.
Not the point, yeah.
And so, you know, I think if you're going to do real estate exposure, you know, some of the best benefits from real estate are actually the tax benefits of real estate. And you want to do that for most people in a situation where you're going to be able to take advantage of those tax benefits.
So what would you say on average is a good return right now if it's not going into a regular money market account where you're making like 1.5 to 2, like maybe 2%?
What kind of money market are you getting that in?
I was going to say, I don't know. My money market is not.
I mean, I'm trying really hard to give everyone the benefit of the doubt here. But like, I mean, what would you say is a comfortable return for somebody who is dabbling in you know, an average investor? What kind of return? Because, like, I mean, Dave Ramsey quotes like 10%, 12% on your money. And I'm thinking, man, that just doesn't seem.
So Dave Ramsey is not as regulated as I am. So he can say stuff like that.
Right. Okay.
He can say, yeah, invest in this and this kind of. I can't tell you what, you know, kind of return people are getting because it's always going to be individual based off of somebody's risk tolerance, based off of their goals. But what I can tell you is that over the long run, the average individual investor actually averages around 2%. Is
oh,
all.
Wow.
Did you know that?
No.
And you want to know the reason for
2%
that?
2% annually or
2%? 2% annually.
Okay.
Yeah. And the reason for that is that the average investor responds emotionally to what happens in the market. And, you know, so when the market's up and it's going up and up, they're like, oh, this is a great market. I want to buy. But they're buying while it's up. And then the market starts going down, down, down. Oh, no, it's going down. I better sell. And so they buy high and they sell low, which is the exact opposite of what you want to do.
It's commonly referred to as a sucker.
And
somebody who
and
buys
apparently,
high and sell
apparently
low.
Individual investors as a whole, that's what they average is sucker returns. With the help of a financial advisor, it tends to be a little bit better. If you look historically, for example, at the S&P 500 over a long period of time, it's almost always averaged over, if you have a greater than 10-year period, 6 to 7% in that range.
Okay.
And that's extremely aggressive, in fact, being invested in the stock market, even though it is diversified against, you know, across the 500 companies in the S&P 500. If you're doing better than that, it's probably luck, not skill.
Okay. Okay, so 6 to 7% over 10 years. And if you're not getting that, then you obviously are not doing a good enough job.
Not necessarily, because it could be that your risk tolerance is different. Do you have some bonds in there? Because that would be 100% stocks that would be returning that. So if you're getting less than that, if your risk-adjusted return might be there. And so it's not just about the total return. It's about risk-adjusted return.
Yeah, what kind of risk are you leveraging?
Right. What are you willing to take? You know, because let's say that, okay, I'm comfortable with 6 to 7% in the stock market. I put, you know, my entire nest egg in the stock market, but I'm planning on using that money in a couple of years because I'm going to build a house. Well, what happens if when you need that money to build a house is right when 2008 happened?
Yeah, then you'd be screwed. Building
a house.
Exactly. So those kind of considerations are things that, you know, people aren't taking into account when they're saying, oh, well, you can get this sort of percentage return. Mm-hmm. And so it's never going to be just about the number. It's going to be about the risk and the goals mm-hmm. for the person.
Hmm. Well, it definitely sounds like having somebody like you would be a good idea.
I think so.
You know.
Yeah.
Just a hunch.
Well, and, you know, we're actually, I think, going through one of the most interesting times in history, and not just because tonight is the State of the Union address in a few minutes, but I think that what they're calling the Fourth Industrial Revolution is going to fundamentally change society, our lives, how we interact with the economy, how we interact with each other. It's probably the biggest change in human society since the Industrial Revolution. You know, they talk about the second and third Industrial Revolution. The second one was electrification, telegraph, railroad. The third one was the digitization. That's computers, internet, everything right now. So the fourth Industrial Revolution is biggest in my mind, robotics, artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, and biotechnology. So robotics. I don't know if you guys ever seen any of the YouTube videos of what Boston Dynamics can do with their robots. Google parkour robot Boston Dynamics.
Okay.
It's amazing and terrifying
all at the same time. You're like, this is how the Terminator started, right? You know, you're like, okay, this robot can run over things. It can jump over things. It can recover from falls already. One of the biggest things holding back, like, you know, the Jetsons general purpose robot is actually computer vision. And so we don't realize how complex our visual cortex is. It's extremely complex. The fact that we can look at, you know, millions of pictures of different chairs and they're all different colors and shapes, but we can still recognize that they're a chair, that's a really, really complex intelligence task. And it's just now that we're figuring out machine learning enough that the artificial intelligences out there are going to be able to do it. You're going to see over the next 5 years some of the biggest leaps in artificial intelligence that we've seen in a long time. Yeah. Artificial intelligence just became the best at Go, chess, and StarCraft, which is probably more complex than either of those other games, believe it or not.
Wow.
That's... I think Elon Musk was saying, maybe it was about a year ago, that he would like to... He's trying to replace all the truck drivers,
right?
Inside the next 10 years.
Yep, and that's something that could very totally easily happen. Well, and you know, it's not just that. You know, you combine the robotics with the artificial intelligence. That's where things start getting really interesting. And you know, we're going to be having conversations that I think we're probably ill-equipped to have on the nature of power, the nature of our relationships with each other, you know, what an economy means when, you know, you could have robots do everything. That's very much within the realms of possibility of the technology that's almost already existent today. We're already seeing the first parts of it. And then the dark uses of that technology, you know, they're working on trying to outlaw killer robots, for example, you know, a robot that could take a human life. You know, that's something that we might actually have to deal with in the next decade, what the laws around that will look like, what the laws around technology to fake people in videos will look like. You know, that's already there.
Well, and I think bringing it back to investment, I think, you know, the fact that you know all of this and that you're investigating it is part of your job, because it involves how people spend their investment dollars. Where are they putting that? Are they putting into robotics?
Yeah, if you have a higher risk tolerance, now might be a time AI to start investing in those emerging technologies.
Yeah, I mean, even at
Inman, most people probably already have that in their 401ks and in their investments. Yeah. You know, and you know, if you own an S&P 500 index, you know, you'll get a little bit of Apple in there, who's investing in artificial intelligence. Google's doing this. You know, it's all the big name companies that we own through our mutual funds that are doing this kind of stuff. So we're already, you know, investing in a lot of these things in maybe a way that doesn't seem immediately apparent to us because we don't draw the dots from, oh yeah, I made a 401k contribution to, oh, that's going into an S&P 500 fund. Oh, that's invested in Apple. Every time somebody buys an iPhone, I get a little, you know, piece of that.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's amazing.
Yeah. And so then the nanotech and the biotech, have you guys heard of CRISPR? So CRISPR
is insane.
CRISPR. So yeah. This caused a big controversy earlier this year. A scientist in China edited human genes inside of embryos in such a way that they'll pass on those edits to their children. So this has caused a big, huge ethical thing in the scientific community using this brand new technology called CRISPR that allows us to edit genes.
Wow.
We can actually write genetic code now. And this is opening up all kinds of avenues for, you know, targeted biotherapeutics, where you could target cancer based off of the ways that it activates to other proteins and amino acids, to being able to edit children, like has already happened in China. And so what he did is he tried to make them resistant to HIV and AIDS, but he did it without really telling the parents what was going on. So there's all these huge ethical quandaries that our technology is opening up for us that we're not even really having the conversations about. But, you know, I think we're going to be having them over the next, you know, decade as we start seeing the impacts of that technology on our lives, because there's so much good that can come from it. You know, you think about, you know, like some of the people that I work with, a widow who can't take very good care of herself anymore. You know, maybe she needs long-term care. Maybe she needs somebody to, you know, run errands for her. You know, a good, you know, Jetson-style robot could help a lot with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's all kinds of things. You know, the drugs that can be developed to help people with, you know, what are now incurable diseases based on CRISPR technology. There is going to be some huge changes and huge opportunities, but also huge problems that we're going to have to work through as, you know, humans together.
I wholeheartedly agree. And there's a lot of interesting stuff on the horizon.
Definitely.
Especially in the medical.
And that's why I think it's a great time to be alive. It's going to be very interesting for all of us.
We get to see some very, very interesting stuff.
Some leaps.
Yes, some leaps. And the great thing is being an investor is you're participating in all of this.
Absolutely.
You know, all these companies that are making these incredible products and, you know, the free market that's bringing everybody's needs together with people who want to meet those needs, you know, that's an incredible thing in a world with, you know, approaching 8 billion humans, you know, or not all that different from each other. And, you know, if we try and find ways to help each other out, I think maybe we'll find a way to muddle through.
Yeah.
Well, sweet.
Wonderful. That's awesome.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jason, for coming in and
I have so much to Google. Taking
the conversation past business, which I think is always fun. So
yeah.
I thought it would be
really appreciate you coming. How can the people get a hold of you?
So you can go to my website, hostlerwealthmanagement.com. Mm-hmm. All our contact information's there. We're just up the street here on Montezuma. Been in town 22 years, so if anybody, you know, needs help with a look at their situation, we'll be glad to do so.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again, and thank you for tuning in this week. Go enjoy the State of the Union. It's starting in about half an hour.
All right.
Which means your other television programs have already been preempted. Until next week, I am Kellen Hoskins with Carissa Maxwell. We hope you're having a beautiful day, and we'll see you next time.